Thanks very much, Steve. This is a very broad topic, the pursuit of wisdom in the age of the internet, and I don't propose to have much to say about that, but I would like to address the issue of science and cultural decline, the internet and education. Russ Neely today, in that wonderful little speech he gave about early education in the United States, observed that things were pretty good until Darwin. And then the character of higher education in America changed. And that was a crisis that others have commented upon in the modern era. Tom Wolfe often, in public lectures, will expound on a topic and then observe that things, there are consequences when people lose their faith in Christianity. I think the cultural decline that we're experiencing, and which seems to be a lament in all the talks that have been given, can be attributed to the distance between experience and propositional reasoning. Not so long ago, when we were children, we learned that God chose to punish mankind for its evil ways, and he sent a flood to destroy the world. After the flood, God gave the survivors, Noah and all the creatures he could save, a symbol of his promise, never again to send another flood that destroyed the world. As children, we were taught the truth of that and believed that God intervenes in history. As adults, we were taught that the rainbow is the effect of light waves that bend when passing through drops of water. Understanding refraction of light is a technological progress, but until recently, most Americans believed the theory of refracted light while simultaneously holding to the faith in God's intervention in history. The subject of this cultural decline is too great to resolve, and it's certainly not my training to do so. But ask yourself if you have experienced that your life has been guided. Have you experienced hope when there was little evidence on which to base that hope? Have you a sense of an ending and of a beginning that are not random? Do you sense that there is justice in itself, though too often the world is unjust? Do you intuitively understand the truth of Aristotle's words when he said, existence is good to the good man? Or do you affirm Socrates' maxim that it's better to suffer injustice than to inflict injustice? That commonly shared experience shapes Western man's understanding of his mortality, his humanity, his obligations to others, and the wisdom literature that shaped the culture of the West. And that is what is under attack and has been under attack in higher education. So what does the internet have to do with that? In a very practical sense, I think that the internet provides an opportunity to go over the heads of the traditional academic establishment and to create your own institutions and gain the accreditation, establish yourself with the federal government in such ways that your students can draw down federal funds for loans and grants for tuition. And at Yorktown University, we've proven that we can do that on an investment of not more than $2 million. So although I was joking with Steve by saying that if you ever aspired to be a president of a university, don't give up the dream, you can. And I think that the challenge that we have is to replace the higher education system that we have, or at least to challenge it, by entering the education marketplace and taking students away from the establishment. The University of Phoenix is doing that. And every student that the University of Phoenix draws away from the establishment is good for America. The fundamental reality we confront is that the scholars who dominate higher education today have abdicated their civic responsibility to educate students for citizenship in a nation of self-governing citizens. Instead of education for citizenship, college students today are offered the freedom to choose any elective that pleases them. Too often, those choices are suffused with political ideology. I know that there are good teachers out there in some disciplines that are very difficult to politicize, such as physical education, the physical sciences, business studies, some economics, and certainly classics. But social sciences, such as political science, sociology, and anthropology, and the humanities, such as history, English literature, American studies, and philosophy, are too often instruments for indoctrination irrelevant specialization, and gender or ethnic dogmatism that serves a politically correct agenda. Reversing that is imperative for the future of American freedom. Back when we were young and there was no Ronald Reagan to give us federal jobs, when our cities and states, as today, were controlled by Democrats, when the Republican Party had been routed, as today, in a calamitous defeat, Lyndon Johnson gained total control of the federal government, and the American people elected a series of disastrous presidents. During those bad times, many in this room chose postgraduate education as a way to educate ourselves and create careers that were not dependent on government or the wise guys and liberals who surrounded American presidents. Go to the directory of the Philadelphia Society and start with the B's. I counted 22 academic members, and that's just in the B's. Back then, in the bad times, these men went to the University of Dallas, Claremont, Indiana University, the University of Washington, Case Western Reserve, Catholic University, University of Pennsylvania, UCLA, Notre Dame, London School of Economics, and other postgraduate institutions. But that was back then. Those of us in this room sought out Wilmore Kendall, Warren Nutter, Milton Friedman, Ludwig von Mises, Michael Oakeshott, George Stigler, James Buchanan, Eric Voegelin, Gerhard Niemeyer, Wilhelm Röpke, Stanley Perry, Donald Treadgold, Stephen Tonser, Leo Strauss, Mario Pei, Martin Diamond, Henry Manny, Harry Jaffa, and the list goes on. Most of those names attended the meetings of the Philadelphia Society. This migration to postgraduate studies as a natural counter to the political and intellectual apathy we found in the greatest generation, the previous generation who learned to appreciate collective action during the Great Depression and World War II, but mistook collectivism for Americanism, drove us into postgraduate education. We sought out scholars to lead us to a better understanding of our predicament and rejected the political apathy and ignorance of our fathers' generation. A parallel movement occurred also that rejected their fathers' ignorance and sought intellectual guides of their own. Shaped by the anti-Vietnam War movement, draft avoidance, a taste for marijuana and LSD, and tribal gathering holes like Haight-Ashbury, Greenwich Village, and Woodstock, a reborn radical left chose academic careers where they were instructed in the thought of Herbert Marcuse, Michel Foucault, Jacques Derrida, and other reconstituted Marxists and postmodern intellectuals who essentially dominate higher education today and really use and see in higher education an instrument for revolution. Academe once was safe, that once was safe haven for progressives and atheists, now became safe haven and a launching pad for new left movements across a spectrum from Marxists, radical feminists, and advocates for Black, Chicano, women's, and gender studies. Today, this migration of disaffected 60s and 70s radicals into academe is totally complete. The result is an industry called the knowledge industry that is hostile territory for students with traditional values, traditional religious faith, respect for authority, and a desire to learn the skills necessary to improve their lot in life. And that has ominous ramifications for civic education of America's educated citizens and gives focus to our topic today. By gaining control of the hiring and tenure process, these 60s and 70s radicals have made it extremely difficult for conservative students to find graduate institutions for professional advancement. If graduate students earn degrees and write dissertations in these subjects today, they find that tenure-track university appointments are difficult to obtain, if not impossible. We've now reached the point that conservatives who aspire to a career of scholarship must disguise their beliefs, suffer through studies controlled by teachers hostile to their traditions, and if lucky, serve in silence in community colleges or backwater four-year institutions until such time as academic tenure is achieved. That explains why, if you see a conservative or Republican who is appointed to serve as president of college or university, he's usually a high-profile conservative politician or lobbyist, not a conservative scholar with administrative experience. There are very few conservative academics in the pipeline at America's universities with college teaching and administrative experience. You may have also noticed that the conservative community is now identified by talk radio hosts, journalists, and gifted politicians, not the scholars of yore who inspired generations to aspire to careers in academe. Can you blame them? Can you give me the names of more than two or three PhD programs in the humanities and social sciences anywhere where at least three conservative scholars assure fair treatment of young PhDs? I know more aspiring scholars who quit graduate school than I do those in graduate school. An important social fact we should consider is the reality that as we conservatives grew in power, as conservatives became more successful politically and conservative academics were excluded from the academy, the leavening influence of scholarship was lessened and our community was dumbed down. I regret to inform you that we conservatives and the American nation are in very grave danger unless we can break the domination of the academy by the ideologues, radicals, rascals, pro-seurs, feminists, and America haters who populate its ranks, dominate its academic departments, and control important search committees. First, let me observe that education is a form of nurture that is best attained when cultivated by persons of scholarly attainment and commitment to the pursuit of truth. True education is not achieved by reacting against ideologues in the classroom. Few gain in knowledge and wisdom from daily contests of wit with their professors. As a result, too many conservative students have become good debaters, but poor scholars. Terry Jeffrey at the Media Research Center told me a story about when he was at Princeton. He took a course in history from a professor who began his first class by announcing that he was an atheist and a Marxist. Immediately, an undergraduate from South Carolina stood up and shouted, "That's the stupidest thing I ever heard. I'm out of here." Now, most of us do not have the courage of that young man from South Carolina. Instead, we sit in silence while our religious faith, our family values, and respect for America is disdained day in and day out. And for that experience, we incur indebtedness of $20,000 and more. For too long, many of us have gained knowledge only by reacting against the ideas of our professors, and too few of us have had the opportunity to study under persons we respect. That is not the pursuit of wisdom. If it's true that education must offer students something they may affirm, how do we justify a system of higher education that offers a little bit of everything but affirms nothing? My colleague on this panel, Christian Koff, teaches at a state university in Colorado, where Yorktown University is domiciled, where the required curriculum is completion of any course from a list of more than 650 electives. University of Colorado at Boulder has some very good, great scholars, but collectively, the faculty of CU can't organize a curriculum of required courses that offer much-needed education in American history, government, economics, religion, and philosophy. Now, here's the political reality. If you require those courses, those departments grow the number of their faculty and increase their power. So it's really a question of consensus that the university faculty must achieve as to which departments we want to give power to. And the answer is, we don't trust any of you, let's just have 650 electives. These so-called parallel universities, the think tanks and conservative student organizations that employ so many PhDs, are becoming less effective. Why use 1950s technologies to import books and great guest speakers onto college campuses when today it is possible to go into the education business and compete for students directly, as I said, for under $2 million? I must conclude that for good or ill, we are compelled to start over, create new colleges and universities, and compete for students with the academic left. Fortunately, the technology is at hand. First Internet University was founded in 1987 using something called DARPANET, which was the origination of the Internet. And it still exists today in another form. Over the next 50 years, if we have 50 years of freedom to enjoy, we must do like Michael Milken, Randy Best, the Becker brothers, and a handful of others who have entered the education marketplace and create new institutions or replace failed ones with technologically rooted internet colleges and universities. If the pursuit of wisdom is to prevail in higher education, we must start new institutions now, not waste time attempting to reform ones that have gone bad. If you and I fail to do that, we will endure generations of barbarism, centralization of power, greater expansion of the administrative state, more freakish election outcomes, more failed presidents of the United States, and loss of our basic freedoms. One step more towards this abyss, and we will hear the words that Alexander Solzhenitsyn heard: hands behind your back. Thank you.